Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Ask Missouri Senator Roy Blunt what worries him the most when it comes to threats from terrorists, and he doesn't hesitate. The internet, he says, that more than food safety or any threat to the electric grid is what keeps him up at night. This week came the news that Edward Snowden's leaks might have killed a remedy for Senator Blunt's concerns, and that is what the New York Times called the equivalent of a Star Wars defense for America's computer networks, designed to intercept cyber attacks before they could cripple power plants, banks, or even financial markets. Our guest today says that the killing of that defense network for America's computers might be only one part of the fallout from the Snowden leaks. David Fidler is a fellow at the Indiana University Center of Applied Cybersecurity Research. He's written extensively on this topic, and he's in town today to speak to the International Relations Council of Kansas City. And David, welcome back to your old haunts here of Kansas City. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, speaking broadly for a minute, just how big a deal do you think the Snowden leaks will prove to be, you know, when it comes to protecting the internet from attack or even protecting online privacy? What do you think?
Well, I think the impact of the Snowden disclosures is quite extensive. We have the national conversation or debate that's already taking place with regards to individuals' privacy.
Yeah.
So that's one issue that's on the agenda. Snowden's disclosures have also given people an idea of just the sheer scale and capability of NSA surveillance, both within the United States but also internationally.
Which we didn't know before and really had not much idea about.
Well, I think most people probably understood that the United States does engage in electronic surveillance and espionage.
Yeah.
But just to understand how we're doing it, to get a bit of a glimpse at just the scale and extent of this. So part of the impact of the Snowden disclosures also has to do with damage that's been caused to U.S. relations with our allies. It's also handed some of our adversaries, particularly China and Russia, a card to play against the United States. So the extent of the damage that Snowden has done to U.S. interests is very, very deep and extensive.
You know, I was really struck by this New York Times story and this idea of a Star Wars-type defense network to protect our computer systems here. You know, this notion that the Snowden leaks may have undermined plans for all of that, how much stock do you put into that idea? Does that make sense to you, there was a cause-and-effect relationship there?
Well, I think politically, yes. One of the debates that was taking place in the United States before the Snowden disclosures, took place was a debate within the federal government about how are we going to better protect our computer systems and the American portion of cyberspace. And one of the big tensions in that debate was between civilian authorities and the military and the DOD. The Department of Homeland Security, our main civilian agency to protect us from these sorts of attacks, you know, technically has the mandate to do that, but it really doesn't have the technical capability to do it. The one agency in the federal government that has that type of technical capability and the resources to do that is the Department of Defense, and the NSA is under DOD's purview. So DOD has been pushing and trying to extend its capabilities to protect more and more of the U.S., a computer network, starting first with defense contractors. But that idea and the feedback and the lessons that they learned from that produced this idea that we could extend this, what the New York Times has called this sort of this cyber Star Wars defense system, where we could be intercepting cyber attacks coming in a more comprehensive way. The New York Times article makes this point, and I agree with it, which is the Snowden disclosures have so politically changed the environment in D.C. on discussing those types of issues that thinking about this comprehensive cyber defense strategy has been set back.
Because this notion – it's been set back politically because this notion that the government is too big and too strong and this would only add to that strength – is what you're undermining this idea then?
Yes. I mean, it plays into this this idea and the fears that people are starting to have that we've only learned part of the story. And so when we only learn parts of the story or we get little pieces of information from leaks that Snowden makes in dribs and drabs, people begin to get worried and they begin potentially to imagine things that may not in fact be going on. And no one in Congress at the moment wants to be perceived to giving authority or pushing forward a plan that would let NSA, DOD protect all computers in the United States from incoming attack.
You know, that being said, and I cover politics here for the newspaper, and when I talk to members of Congress and folks who are in the know about things like this, you ask them, as I introduced the show today, what worries them the most when it comes to a potential terrorist threat? And obviously, we live out here in the breadbasket, and you might think the food supply would come up a lot, and it used to. But these days, what I hear consistently from member after member is an attack on the internet and what that might mean for all of us going forward.
Yes, and that fear has risen on the sort of the priority list of national security and foreign policy in the United States. So you hear this all the time, and the vulnerabilities are real and the threats are serious. The question is, what do we do about those threats? And this is where, before Snowden, right, the United States government was having trouble moving forward with regards to identifying a strategy and then implementing that. Just an example in terms of protecting critical infrastructure. So power, electricity, water.
I'm sorry, what's the issue? What's the question? Why isn't it clear what we need to do? We need to protect the power grid, protect the internet. Why aren't those clear objectives?
Well, I think the objectives are clear, but how we go about doing it is the controversy. And so that's not unusual in national security policy. We want to deal with terrorists. We want to put in place counterterrorism measures that are how do we do that? Mm-hmm. Aggressive interrogation techniques, Guantanamo Bay. There's always controversies about how we go about achieving those objectives. So in terms of some of the worries about terrorists using cyber attacks against the United States, one of the concerns in that area has been attacking critical infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
But Congress has not been able to agree on legislation, right, to move forward a strategy to better protect critical infrastructure in the United States.
And Congress needs to pass something in order to get that done?
Yes.
The government couldn't go off on its own and do this through executive order or whatever? Yeah.
The failure of Congress to agree on cybersecurity legislation meant that President Obama in February of this year put out an executive order trying to move at least the executive branch forward as much as possible without legislation to create incentives for industry and others to improve cybersecurity. But it's a second best approach to having Congress lay out a comprehensive strategy and then give authority mm-hmm. to those agencies that need that authority to better protect us from cyber incidents.
You know, let's step back just for a moment here and talk about cybersecurity 101 and what a terrorist attack on the internet might mean. I mean, what are we talking about here? That one day I might go to the computer in the morning to check my checking account and how much money I have, and that information is suddenly gone? Or what are we talking about?
Yeah, well, the area of cybersecurity policy is very interesting because often we'll use the term cyber attacks for lots of different types of problems that we face. So when we try to analytically break down cybersecurity policy, one approach to this is to sort of say, all right, are we talking about cyber crime? So we've got non-state actors there trying to steal your identity or steal your money,
right.
You know, fraud, things of that nature. A second category, policy category that we look at is the terrorism. So terrorists are using cyber attacks to further their particular purposes.
To screw up the internet and screw up all our lives.
Yeah. And interestingly, we have not yet had a single example of a terrorist group engaging in a cyber attack.
And that surprises me.
And it surprises a lot of people. Now, it's not that terrorists don't use the internet. They use the internet to communicate. They use the internet to raise money. They use the internet for propaganda
purposes. Bin Laden did that, right.
Yeah, but they haven't used the internet to attack one of their enemies or adversaries. And people speculate as to why that's the case. Another policy category that we look at is espionage. So the big issue before Snowden's disclosure in early June was the United States getting very upset about Chinese cyber espionage. I don't know if you recall that before the summit took place, and Snowden's revelations have changed the nature of that conversation. And then the fourth category is war, right? Armed conflict. So the use of cyber weapons in the context of armed conflict. People tend to just sort of talk about cyber attacks in a very general way, but when we approach these things from a policy point of view, at least one strategy is to break them down into these categories. And this is where when people say, I'm most worried about cyber terrorism, many cybersecurity experts say, why? We haven't had any attacks. And the nature of cyber weapons might not actually be attractive to terrorists.
One of those categories, you know, cyber terrorism on the internet. What might happen? What could happen? And how vulnerable are we? If someone went after the internet and wanted to toss it offline or whatever the terminology is, what would happen to us? What does that mean?
It would depend on the nature of the attack and the consequences from that. So some people fear that terrorists will say, go after our financial infrastructure. And if you can't get a hold of money, companies don't know where their resources are, the economy begins to break down, people begin to panic. And so it's creating these sort of collateral, ripple effects through an economy. And we know terrorists, at least in terms of using conventional weapons, are interested in not only the immediate damage caused, but all of the direct and indirect economic damage that their attack is going to inflict on the United States. And 9/11 is a classic example.
They're going to mess us up and mess us up for a long time to come. Lots of panic, lots of uncertainty, everyone worried,
right.
Everyone wanting cash in their hands.
Right. Yeah. And then how we respond to that, right, is also going to be very, very expensive. So we think of all the resources that we've spent in the war on terrorism is a direct cost of that 9/11 attack. So we can spin out these scenarios in sort of very apocalyptic senses, but that's where experts stop and say, well, we have to step back from that because we can scare ourselves into doing things that may not be useful. Are terrorists actually going to be interested in using cyber weapons against the United States or its allies? So far, they have not been. Will they in the future? Well, we don't know. Terrorists are often motivated by seeing a lot of, dead bodies or physical damage that's very visceral in a propaganda sense. You don't really have that if you want to use a cyber weapon.
Yeah. David Fidler is our guest. He's a fellow at the Indiana University Center of Applied Cybersecurity Research. He's in town to speak on behalf of the International Relations Council of Kansas City. I'll have some information about his talk tonight. Again, we're talking this morning about the threats, cyber threats against perhaps the internet and what that might mean going forward. Just how vulnerable are we to a cyber attack when it comes to any of the categories you mentioned? What's your sense of how vulnerable we are and how easy it would be to pull something like that off?
Well, both the public sector or what we call the .gov world, as well as the private sector or the .com world, is very vulnerable. And this is something that cyber criminals have learned. And of those sort of four categories, those policy categories I described, the two biggest areas where we see these vulnerabilities very starkly are in the scale and the intensity of cybercrime and in cyber espionage. Mm-hmm. That's where we've seen the vast majority of activity. We haven't seen any cyber terrorism.
Meaning stealing my identity or something like that.
Stealing your identity, mm-hmm. stealing your Social Security. And then they'll sell that information on markets that have developed all around the world, which are also virtual. So the person that hacks into your system or your bank or your credit card company may not be the one actually stealing your money, but they will take that information and sell it on these markets that have developed to people who will then use that to gain, access to resources or other types of information or theft of intellectual property that's valuable to companies. And so it's been quite clear for a long time that, both government systems as well as systems in the private sector, your individual systems in your home computer, your individual smartphone that you carry around with you every day, all of these systems are very vulnerable to being accessed without authorization by outside actors, whether that's a criminal group, a terrorist group, or another government.
And so the potential threat could come in several forms, if I'm hearing you right, David. It's stealing information out of your computer, which you may not even know it's been stolen.
Correct.
When it happens. It could be inserting bugs into computer systems to destroy them in
Correct.
Some way. Mm-hmm. Could it even be physically damaging memory banks, mainframe storage facilities somewhere?
Yes.
That would – all those things are possible.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, you can – they have – and malware has been used and can easily be developed, for example, to wipe hard drives. Right, so it doesn't physically destroy your computer. Your computer's still sitting, on your desk, but all the data's gone. Your hard drive won't work. And, that's a vulnerability that, both the government and the private sector have been trying to do things to protect against that. But it in some ways, it's kind of an arms race, right?
Yeah.
There's a response to the offensive attempt to steal information or to damage computers. And so that response then makes it harder for the cyber criminal. Then they up their game, right?
Yeah.
And so it's this sort of spiral of defense offense. What experts are often worried about, at least in terms of cyber in cybersecurity and in cyberspace, the offense always has the advantage. And overcoming that is going to be difficult without rethinking some of these defensive responsive strategies that, you know, have been tried.
This is really interesting. Really interesting. David Fidler speaks this evening at 7 at the UMKC Law School Courtroom. That's at 500 East 52nd Street in Kansas City on the UMKC campus. The talk is free for a current International Relations Council of Kansas City members, $15 for non-members. More information, go to kcur.org to see more about David Fidler's visit tonight. So you're the expert here, David. Again, you're a fellow at the Indiana University Center on Applied Cybersecurity Research. What do you worry about the most? I mean, what should members of Congress be concerned about the most?
Well, I think at the moment, and again, I'll reflect on what we're seeing coming out of the consequences of Edward Snowden's leak.
Yeah, right.
The first is, people are talking about this national conversation now that we're having about privacy and national security. And I worry about this because I honestly don't know where this conversation is going to go. And I think it's difficult for people to engage in this conversation for a number of reasons. One is people have wildly different interpretations of what Snowden has done and whether mm-hmm. he's a hero or a whistleblower or a traitor. So it makes it difficult to talk about Snowden. But I also think it's forcing people to think about how they, access data, use data, participate in cyberspace. Do we have the same sort of relationship with our own information, concepts of privacy and national security in this early part of the 21st century that we may have had before the internet became the force that it is today? A second aspect of this, I think, is it complicates, and I worry about this, it complicates efforts in Washington, D.C. to try to improve our responses to our vulnerabilities. And this goes to this notion that things politically are just too difficult or too controversial at the moment for some of these strategies to be put in place. And then third, this has really damaged U.S. interests overseas.
In what way?
Well, let's go back to the example of the United States getting very upset about Chinese cyber espionage before the Snowden leaks. This was all the news in Washington, D.C. In cybersecurity, this was the issue. Snowden comes along, discloses not only the extent to which the U.S. government is engaging in surveillance within the United States, collecting metadata on all of our local telephone calls. Snowden also released information about how much the United States engaged in cyber espionage in China, hacking into Chinese universities, Chinese businesses, Chinese government, the Chinese military. And so this just completely took away any momentum the Obama administration was trying to achieve with pushing back against China. So China wasn't really terribly interested in listening to us before Edward Snowden came along. Now the Chinese simply don't have to listen to us because they think this is hypocritical of the United States to lecture China about its cyber espionage when look at the scale and the extent of what the U.S. is doing here. And that's the same with our relationships with Russia and some of our other adversaries, but also it's upset our allies. Snowden also disclosed information about how the United States allegedly, spies on our allies. And the Germans and many other countries in the European Union got very upset. The German government has canceled its intelligence sharing agreement with the United States as a consequence of these leaks. And so that, again, I think, eventually we'll come back around with our allies and get to more of an equilibrium. But in the meantime, the damage is being done. Other countries are playing this card against the United States. John Kerry this week is in Latin America. He was going to Brazil, and he was catching it in the neck from the Brazilians and the other Latin Americans about NSA surveillance in that region. So other countries can use this against the United States, and that harms our interests. So I worry particularly about that because it's very difficult to see how we overcome that problem on the international side.
I mean, this is – I'm going to get to some phone calls here in a minute. If you want to join our conversation, I want to know what your view is here. Does the U.S. government have the right to stockpile electronic information about you in a quest to root out terrorism? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. You know, and yet, even – Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill this week from Missouri was talking to me about all of this and describing the fine line the federal government is trying to walk here, because citizens expect the government to protect all of us from these kinds of attacks that you're outlining. And yet, of course, there are these obvious privacy concerns that arise here as well. I mean, this is not easy stuff.
No, it is not. And drawing that line or achieving that equilibrium between, our perceptions of what's the appropriate amount of privacy and the national security interests that we have is difficult. And that balance between security and liberty is something that haunts national security policy and law going back to the founding, you know, of the Republic.
Yeah.
It's not a new issue. What makes, I think, cyber different in terms of thinking about striking that balance and why it really is such a very, very difficult political and policy issue is that, unlike some of the other national security challenges that we face, if we think about other types of weapons technologies, chemical weapons,
yeah,
radiological weapons, biological weapons, you know, when I walk into my office in the morning, I don't have a stockpile of biological weapons there.
Glad to hear it. Yeah.
I walk into my office and I got a desktop, I got an iPad, I've got a smartphone. I have a relationship and a dependence on these technologies that does not exist with regards to some of these other things. So how I relate to that and that privacy issue, I think, just becomes much more palpable for people. They're posting information on Facebook. They're using their cell phones. They're using email. They're using Twitter. And all this information is stored in digital format and is accessible either by companies or, in this context, the government. How should we think about that data? What's our understanding of our rights to privacy in a context where everything is dependent on these technologies?
Yeah.
And that makes it difficult for the government to step into these realms. And that's part of the controversy underlying some of the legal authorities that exist for collecting this information.
And maybe these questions are just reflective of the fact that the internet is still a fairly new phenomenon, and we're still trying to figure out the culture around it in some ways.
Yes. And we can sort of, even though the internet's not, you know, very old in, you know, historical terms, we have seen an evolution of how we relate to the internet and then also to cyberspace. Once upon a time, cyberspace was somewhere that we went outside of our real world, right? We had this sort of idea it was somewhere else. It was a virtual world out there that was somehow different from our real world. But as we became more dependent on the internet and all the applications the internet supports, our real worlds and the virtual world sort of collided, meshed, and integrated themselves. So, you know, when you look at some of the younger generation, which is much more adept at these technologies than I ever will be, they relate to these things in a way that's just so very different. It is part of our daily life. There's no more virtual world versus real world.
Yes.
And when those
yes.
things come together, again, I think that just heightens the sensitivities about trying to insert national security protections into something that's become so much a part of our daily lives.
I bet you're a lot hotter property these days since the Snowden thing, right? People want to talk to you.
Yeah, I mean Snowden's sort of been full employment for cybersecurity experts.
David Fidler is our guest again. He speaks this evening at 7 at the UMKC Law School Courtroom, 500 East 52nd Street. More information about that, kcur.org. Our number here again, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some calls. Jenny from Overland Park, thanks for calling, Jenny.
Hi. Well, perfect segue from your guest. I really appreciate this show. I work at a local hospital. I won't say which one, but I work at a facility that's brand new. We have all updated equipment and everything. However, this past Saturday night, the network went down system-wide, just with no warning. All of a sudden, we could not access our computers. Well, everything is on computer. We don't even do paper charts. We don't do films for x-rays. X-rays are digital, and they get sent out over the network to a radiologist. In the blink of an eye, we lost every potential capability that could not be performed with pen and paper. We couldn't print because all of our printers are on network. We didn't even have a cord available, a cable available anywhere in the facility so that we could hardwire even one printer. And then we found out that all of our terminals that we use are truly terminals and not PCs. So, like, even Microsoft Word, we were desperately trying to draft patient forms, but we couldn't do that because even our software was housed on a server that we couldn't get to.
Wow.
And,
wow.
I mean, it was shocking. We, afterwards, it took about 2.5 hours for the network to be restored. We had patients in who we couldn't get their x-rays read.
And Jay, what was the consequence of all this? Give us a sense of that. What happened?
You know, I know that there was a leaders meeting to go over lessons learned.
I can imagine.
The head of the facility. Yeah, he actually came in, and we had a lot of good support from administration. But, you know, I said to him, I'm like, we've got to have at least one computer terminal with resident software, with all of our forms, with a hardwired printer, at least one for a backup. So I think what was so shocking to us was not only how completely dependent on the network we were, but how unprepared we were, because all of our procedures were based
right.
on software problems and not hardware problems.
Jane, let me just get David a comment. I'm guessing her experience at her local hospital, that would be replicated hundreds and hundreds and thousands of times if a cyber attack should be successful here.
Yes, and sometimes when systems go down, it isn't necessarily because of an outside intrusion or a cyber incident.
Clearly.
So something happens because
yeah.
of the nature of the digital technology and the software that we have. Things go wrong. Bugs are in there, glitches. And so that story, you know, has been told, will be told, you know, many, many times. And you just think about adding that up over the, you know, the United States, and you begin to see, you know, the economic consequences of this, potential consequences to people in healthcare industry or other industries, because they're all dependent, utterly dependent upon these technologies yeah. in the same way. And we're all in that you know, world together. And it's not as if we have a choice. If you want to function in this economy, in this society, you can't air gap yourself. You can't
yeah.
sort of take yourself offline. And that's part, again, the part of the evolution of our relationship with the Internet and cyberspace.
Let's go back to some calls here. Clinton from Kansas City, Missouri. Clinton, good morning.
Hey, what's going on?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I've been thinking about this a lot lately as far as the Ed Snowden link and things like that. And, you know, people are like, oh, is he a traitor? Is he a hero? I kind of look at him as like a cheating spouse's, the spouse is being cheated on, like best friend that like accidentally intercepts a text message and goes, oh my, I need to tell my friend about this. You know, the government's been cheating, you know, this whole time. And hoping that they don't get caught. Now they've been caught, and now they're pointing fingers like it was, you know, somebody else's fault here, you know. And we've been talking about, like you're saying, about China with the espionage thing, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, and now the conversation has absolutely changed, because how can we talk to China about espionage when we're doing the same thing? How can the government be mad about backlash from this when they've been doing it knowingly the whole time and just kind of hoping they didn't get caught, like a cheating spouse? I mean,
yeah, we got you, Clinton. David?
Well, I think the government's response is, if you look at what Edward Snowden has disclosed, and people have made this argument time and time again, he hasn't disclosed what a lot of people would think would be abuses of power. People differ about whether or not some of the legal authorities that the administration has pointed to actually support what they've done here, but the argument that they're exercising authority Congress gave to the executive that's been reviewed by an Article III court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, makes what the government has been doing here unlike cheating on a spouse, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the briefings that they've given to Congress. I don't think that answers all of the problems and concerns that we have in this context, but I do know that even for experts, right, trying to figure out exactly what's happened, what are the legal authorities, and have they gone beyond those to the point at which we really ought to be worried is extremely difficult.
Just quickly, David, you wrote on your blog, I was going to point out the name of your blog here too. Remind me what it is?
Yeah, this is a blog called Arms Control Law.
arms control law,
right.
And you'll find armscontrollaw.com. Here it is. And you write under the cyber category where you can find some of some of your articles. But you talk on there about this notion that the government has been contending that under the Patriot Act, it's lawful for them to collect and store all these logs of every phone call dialed and received in the U.S. They say it's legal. You have questions with that. What's your issue with that, just briefly?
Yes, and this is part of the one of the programs that Snowden's disclosures have exposed, and this is the collection of what's called telephony metadata in the United States.
It is metadata, this new phrase we hear a lot about.
And so that's just information about numbers dialed, numbers that call your phone, you know, duration of calls, things of that. Not the content, right? But just sort of the what is the term metadata. So the administration has argued that something called Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act provides it with the authority to collect that metadata, to store it, and then if they have information from other surveillance, to access that and do a more precise search. My concern with that is I don't think the statutory requirements in Section 215 support what the administration is doing with that particular surveillance program. I don't think, for example, that collecting all local phone calls of all U.S. citizens is relevant to an authorized investigation. If everything's relevant, then we really have a problem here. And so if Congress actually wants the administration to have, or the executive branch to have, that sort of authority, then we need to have Congress actually say that rather than having these very expansive and aggressive interpretations of the law.
That's interesting. Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Al, good morning. You're on with David Fidler. Good morning.
Morning, guys. Great show. You know, there's a new information landscape, and that's the thing we're working out right now. I mean, anarchy, there's nothing moral or ethical about anarchy. You know, that's the sentimental illusion about it. What is important is good government, and that's, I think, the issue here, and that's being ironed out. Snowden acted in an anarchic way, and it was an anarchistic activity that he did on his own volition. He was unsupervised and so forth. What he has caused is a lot of problems. He hasn't brought anything to light, really, that wasn't already known in certain circles in Washington. The cheating spouse metaphor really isn't correct, because all of his information was known and has been known for a long time in Washington. And actually, in the 70s, with the big social upheavals, I was part of this. We were all tracked, and we were visited by FBI agents, and we knew that the government was always looking at all these things. So there's nothing new here on that level. But the new landscape, the information landscape, is new. And I think that's what it's about. And as far as Snowden is concerned, you know, everyone's glorifying this guy, but in the reality, he was a wild card who really did not understand how government works and the importance of moral and ethical government.
Is Al have a point?
I think so, but there are questions about whether or not even people inside the Beltway fully understood the extent and scale of what the government was doing.
But I think Al's right. Some members of Congress did, right?
Yes. I mean, the administration, as part of its argument that what it's doing, even with the metadata, you know, program in the United States, fully briefed not only the members of the House and Senate Permanent Intelligence Committees, but made information available to every member of Congress. The problem with that, and you see this in the documents, is we're giving you all of this information, but remember, it's classified, so you can't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you have a legislative debate about the extent of what we're doing? And this is, for example, you know, Senator Wyden's problem, right? He kept making these cryptic comments that people didn't understand what he was talking about, but he was trying to raise issues about this, but he couldn't actually talk about it.
Do they go behind closed doors and have debates on sensitive national security issues like this?
Certainly, but if you're talking about legislative authority that Congress has supposedly given to the executive branch,
how do you have that conversation?
This is a deliberative democracy. So we have to have more transparency to discuss these issues. issues. So the idea that Congress reauthorized this twice, being fully briefed, doesn't answer the question for me, because they couldn't actually have a debate, open debate, about classified information made available by the executive branch. So even at that level, it gets very complicated.
David, we're going to have to leave our conversation right there, but in our business, we call guys like you money. You were just terrific. What an interesting conversation. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
Again, that's David Fidler. He speaks this evening at 7 at the UMKC Law School on behalf of the International Relations Council of Kansas City. More information about that, kcur.org.